Listening test, task one. You are going to listen to a recording about the impact of photojournalism. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, choose the correct answer, A, B, C, or D, for each question 1 to 7. Put a cross in the correct box on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
We were just hearing from photographer Warren Richardson. Here's photographs of Syrians crossing the Hungarian border fence, and one photo in particular won the World Press Photo of the Year. Well, there are, of course, many other winning pictures in this exhibition. And FM4's Rosie Waite asked Sanne Schim van der Leuve from the World Press Photo Foundation what the collection as a whole tells us about the state of the world today.
I think it tells us a lot about the way the world is developing, and specifically about how we consider the world as a whole rather than as separate entities. So there's two dominant themes. One's quite obvious, that's the refugees that have been fleeing Syria and other countries because of the wars. A second theme, however, is also the relationship between humans in more generally and the environment and how we treat our environment. So you see some images dealing with the catastrophic consequences of the earthquake in Nepal and the ensuing avalanche as well at Mount Everest Base Camp, but also some images that visualize very strongly the smog and the pollution that we're creating in the world, specifically in China, unfortunately.
And what for you makes a really captivating picture?
I think for me personally, specifically in photojournalism, I think it's a photographer who can draw me in and then can just hit me with some information that I might have not seen at first. So there's an example in this exhibition of a series by a Russian photographer called Sergei Ponomarev, and his series does also deal with the refugees. And there's one specific image in that series where the first time I looked at the photograph, you see beautiful sun and grass, and there's this white horse in the middle of the image. And then you take a step closer, and the reality of the photograph is this kind of hidden behind the grass, is this huge crowd of people, refugees walking, being guided by a border policeman sitting on top of this white horse.
And do you think that photography still has the potential to make a difference, to help people to change politics?
I do, and I also think more than anything that it needs to. So there's actually a series in this exhibition by a Portuguese photographer, Mario Cruz, who created a series in Senegal dealing with boarding schools that were actually having children come to their boarding schools under the pretense that they would be learning the Quran and going to school and everything. Now, in reality, they were being used basically as slaves, begging on the streets, child soldiers, living in horrible circumstances. Now, because of the publication of that particular series, the local government actually launched an investigation and ended up freeing a lot of the kids that were stuck in a lot of these schools. So I think this is an example of the power that photography and photojournalism still has. And also, it reinforces this idea that we need it. We need visuals to change the world because it's the strongest way to get a message across.
We were just hearing from photographer Warren Richardson. Here's photographs of Syrians crossing the Hungarian border fence, and one photo in particular won the World Press Photo of the Year. Well, there are, of course, many other winning pictures in this exhibition. And FM4's Rosie Waite asked Sanne Schim van der Leuve from the World Press Photo Foundation what the collection as a whole tells us about the state of the world today?
I think it tells us a lot about the way the world is developing, and specifically about how we consider the world as a whole rather than as separate entities. So there's two dominant themes. One's quite obvious. That's the refugees that have been fleeing Syria and other countries because of the wars. A second theme, however, is also the relationship between humans in more generally and the environment and how we treat our environment. So you see some images dealing with the catastrophic consequences of the earthquake in Nepal and the ensuing avalanche as well at Mount Everest base camp, but also some images that visualize very strongly the smog and the pollution that we're creating in the world, specifically in China, unfortunately.
And what for you makes a really captivating picture?
I think for me personally, specifically in photojournalism, I think it's a photographer who can draw me in and then can just hit me with some information that I might have not seen at first. So there's an example in this exhibition of a series by a Russian photographer called Sergei Ponomarev, and his series does also deal with the refugees. And there's one specific image in that series where the first time I looked at the photograph, you see beautiful sun and grass, and there's this white horse in the middle of the image. And then you take a step closer, and the reality of the photograph is this kind of hidden behind the grass, is this huge crowd of people, refugees walking, being guided by a border policeman sitting on top of this white horse.
And do you think that photography still has the potential to make a difference, to help people to change politics?
I do, and I also think more than anything that it needs to. So there's actually a series in this exhibition by a Portuguese photographer, Mario Cruz, who created a series in Senegal dealing with boarding schools that were actually having children come to their boarding schools under the pretense that they would be learning the Quran and going to school and everything. Now, in reality, they were being used basically as slaves, begging on the streets, child soldiers, living in horrible circumstances. Now, because of the publication of that particular series, the local government actually launched an investigation and ended up freeing a lot of the kids that were stuck in a lot of these schools. So I think this is an example of the power that photography and photojournalism still has. And also, it reinforces this idea that we need it. We need visuals to change the world because it's the strongest way to get a message across.
Task 2. You are going to listen to a report about a hike and bike trail in New York. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, complete the sentences 1 to 9 using a maximum of 4 words. Write your answers in the spaces provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
The Old Putnam Trail in Van Cortlandt Park is one of New York City's few true trails, so it's popular with runners and walkers. The trail used to be part of a rail line, and in places, wooden railroad ties still poke through the packed dirt path. But trees and underbrush have started to reclaim the space, and some sections of the former train track are barely wide enough for two people to pass through side by side. The trail borders the Tibbetts wetland where birdwatchers go to see swans, red-winged blackbirds, hawks.
It has a very rustic, natural feel to it. And it feels like a natural trail that you would find anywhere in the countryside. And yet it's here in the Bronx. People are amazed by that.
This is Suzanne Korber, one of the founders of the organization Save the Putnam Trail. She lives near Van Cortlandt Park and has been walking and running on the trail for more than 15 years.
It's a way to get out of the city and get renewal. You feel differently when you start the trail to when you end it. It's like a purification process.
Korber says the trail isn't just good for people, it's also good for the environment. It helps filter stormwater before it reaches the wetlands. Freshwater wetlands like this one are scarce in the city. It's home to a unique collection of plants and amphibians. The Tibbetts wetland thus provides shelter and food for migratory birds traveling up and down the East Coast. And that's where the controversy comes in. Environmentalists say the park needs to remain as it is, not only to provide access to nature for people, but also to protect the wetlands. But the New York Parks Department wants to pave the Putnam Trail to make it accessible for cyclists and wheelchairs.
It's all going to be a paved asphalt path between 8 and 10 feet wide.
This is Jennifer Greenfeld. She's the chief of forestry, horticulture, and natural resources for the New York City Parks Department. Rain slides right off asphalt, carrying with it sediments and oil. Greenfeld says the Parks Department has a solution for that.
In some cases, we have what's called a bioswale on the edges of the trail. So as water it drains off the asphalt, it will go into this sort of vegetated buffer that will capture any sediment that's coming off the trail. And that's only when we're within 100 feet of the wetland.
Whether or not the bioswales will provide an adequate buffer to capture pollutants depends on whom you ask. The Parks Department says they will. Save the Putnam Trail says they won't. The nonprofit environmental organization New York City Audubon says the answer won't become clear till the trail is actually built. That said, Audubon Society ornithologist Susan Elbin has another concern about the pavement. She says too much asphalt can limit the natural movement of a wetland.
Marshes and wetlands, they're like living organisms, and they need to have room to move around. And it's beaches, too. It's all very dynamic. It's not like, you know, putting in a concrete pool and there it is.
So if there's too much development constraining the wetland,
those birds and associated birds and other wildlife with them gets crunched in the middle and has nowhere to go.
There's already a golf course near the wetland, and a major freeway runs nearby. So there's already a lot of constraints on this wetland. Even so, Elbin says,
I would love to say, protect it, you know, no more development anywhere, but, you know, that's just not realistic. So then the next step is we're at the table to come up with the compromises or to suggest solutions.
More than half the global population lives in cities, and the UN estimates that by 2050, two-thirds of the world's people will live in urban areas. Urban green spaces have public health benefits, and they also provide needed habitat for animals. But green spaces are limited, and decisions about how to balance the needs of different users inevitably lead to conflict. The Old Putnam Trail in Van Cortlandt Park is one of New York City's few true trails, so it's popular with runners and walkers. The trail used to be part of a rail line, and in places, wooden railroad ties still poke through the packed dirt path. But trees and underbrush have started to reclaim the space, and some sections of the former train track are barely wide enough for two people to pass through side by side. The trail borders the Tibbetts wetland where birdwatchers go to see swans, red-winged blackbirds, hawks.
It has a very rustic, natural feel to it. And it feels like a natural trail that you would find anywhere in the countryside. And yet it's here in the Bronx. People are amazed by that.
This is Suzanne Korber, one of the founders of the organization Save the Putnam Trail. She lives near Van Cortlandt Park and has been walking and running on the trail for more than 15 years.
It's a way to get out of the city and get renewal. You feel differently when you start the trail to when you end it. It's like a purification process.
Korber says the trail isn't just good for people, it's also good for the environment. It helps filter stormwater before it reaches the wetlands. Freshwater wetlands like this one are scarce in the city. It's home to a unique collection of plants and amphibians. The Tibbetts wetland thus provides shelter and food for migratory birds traveling up and down the East Coast. And that's where the controversy comes in. Environmentalists say the park needs to remain as it is, not only to provide access to nature for people, but also to protect the wetlands. But the New York Parks Department wants to pave the Putnam Trail to make it accessible for cyclists and wheelchairs.
It's all going to be a paved asphalt path between 8 and 10 feet wide.
This is Jennifer Greenfeld. She's the chief of forestry, horticulture, and natural resources for the New York City Parks Department. Rain slides right off asphalt, carrying with it sediments and oil. Greenfeld says the Parks Department has a solution for that.
In some cases, we have what's called a bioswale on the edges of the trail. So as water it drains off the asphalt, it will go into this sort of vegetated buffer that will capture any sediment that's coming off the trail. And that's only when we're within 100 feet of the wetlands.
Whether or not the bioswales will provide an adequate buffer to capture pollutants depends on whom you ask. The Parks Department says they will. Save the Putnam Trail says they won't. The nonprofit environmental organization New York City Audubon says the answer won't become clear till the trail's actually built. That said, Audubon Society ornithologist Susan Elbin has another concern about the pavement. She says too much asphalt can limit the natural movement of a wetland.
Marshes and wetlands, they're like living organisms, and they need to have room to move around. And beaches, too. It's all very dynamic. It's not like, you know, putting in a concrete pool and there it is.
So if there's too much development constraining the wetland,
those birds and associated birds and other wildlife with them gets crunched in the middle and has nowhere to go.
There's already a golf course near the wetland, and a major freeway runs nearby. So there's already a lot of constraints on this wetland. Even so, Elbin says,
I would love to say, protect it, you know, no more development anywhere, but, you know, that's just not realistic. So then the next step is we're at the table to come up with the compromises or to suggest solutions.
More than half the global population lives in cities, and the UN estimates that by 2050, two-thirds of the world's people will live in urban areas. Urban green spaces have public health benefits, and they also provide needed habitat for animals. But green spaces are limited, and decisions about how to balance the needs of different users inevitably lead to conflict.
Task 3. You are going to listen to a conversation about concentration and distraction. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences 1 to 7 with the sentence endings A to J. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
The commonsensical answer is that distraction is the opposite of concentration. It's like a state of mind during which you are incapable of concentrating or attending in a deliberate way. And that seems to make sense and, you know, is reasonable enough. But the problem with distraction is that in a lot of cases, what counts as distraction varies depending on the context and on who's involved in your situation. It's really a choice about what you want to attend to. So on some level, the things that we are distracted by are things that we happen to be paying attention to at that moment. If you think about, you know, a student in a boring lecture, from the professor's point of view, that student is a distracted student. But from the student's point of view, the professor is boring, and being lost in your own more valuable thoughts isn't distraction. It's actually concentrating on something that's worthwhile. And then the other way that distraction is a complicated thing is that if you look at the self-help shelf, you get the sense that distraction is always bad. But it's not always bad. It's often good. So that's why writers work in coffee shops, because a little bit of distraction helps keep your brain humming along. And that's why my dentist likes to hum AM rock songs as a means of distracting you from the fact that you're at the dentist.
Does it work?
And it does work. He said he used to be a ski instructor. He told a story about when he used to be a ski instructor. You know, one thing ski instructors do is they distract scared students from the fact that they're slowly sliding down a mountain by talking a lot. And distraction helps you learn in that case. So basically, distraction is a more various and valuable thing than it's often assumed to be when we talk about it just as this scourge of modern life.
I buy all of that, Josh, but I wonder if another way of coming at this to understand what distraction really is to talk about our distractions, the things that we do that we think of distractions. And I'm going to put you on the spot, Andrew, and ask you, like, what comes to mind? What are the things that you know that you do that you think, oh, I'm now distracted, I'm doing X?
Sorry, I was just thinking about whether I wanted another cookie. I wasn't really paying attention. Kidding. I think that Josh is right, that what counts as distraction is context dependent. And so distraction to me is anything that I didn't mean to be attending to. Like, any time that I find myself like, wait, how did I end up on Facebook? How did I actually just click a banner ad? And it's not just the internet. I mean, this is why when you study meditation, which I have done, that is teaching you how to just be aware of the paths that your brain goes down, whether it is just sitting in a chair or in front of a screen or in a lecture. You don't have to be sitting in a lecture in order to struggle to pay attention. You could struggle to pay attention even when all the stimuli are stripped away. So to me, distraction is anything that I didn't mean to do. Like Josh writes about, if I'm sitting in a movie theater and I decide this trailer is boring, I'm going to go check my email. That's not distraction. That's a decision. A distraction is when it's like, I didn't even know I took my phone out of my pocket. Mm-hmm. So it's all about control. I think the thing that freaks us out at this deep level is it feels like a loss of free will.
And something that you hit on was not even realizing you're doing it, which right. I think is a key component of what distraction is. You directed us to a TED talk by Sherry Turkle called Connected But Alone, in which she talks about the scourge of iPhones and what they're doing to social behavior. And one part of that really hit home to me when she was talking about how we do things with our phones now that we would never have considered to be proper behavior as recently as a decade ago. And an example of that in the workplace is, and David and I go to a meeting every day in which this happens, people are just sitting there on their phones, including me, mm-hmm. while other people speak. Mm-hmm. How is that decent behavior in a social world?
Oh, I'm so happy to defend that. because meetings are boring. I mean, it just gets what Josh was saying before. To my mind, when I'm in a meeting and you're talking about things that have varying degrees of importance to each mm-hmm. of the people as the meeting progresses in their times when it's really your turn to listen or speak and times mm-hmm. when it's not. And so I'm, you know, usually checking my email to see if there are other work things going on. Mm-hmm. And that I have no problem with. But as you were saying, Andrew, I mean, I did choose to do that. So maybe that's why it doesn't feel like a distraction
and
to me.
Also, just given the way our brains work.
The commonsensical answer is that distraction is the opposite of concentration. It's like a state of mind during which you are incapable of concentrating or attending in a deliberate way. And that seems to make sense and, you know, is reasonable enough. But the problem with distraction is that in a lot of cases, what counts as distraction varies depending on the context and on who's involved in your situation. It's really a choice about what you want to attend to. So on some level, the things that we are distracted by are things that we happen to be paying attention to at that moment. If you think about, you know, a student in a boring lecture, from the professor's point of view, that student is a distracted student. But from the student's point of view, the professor is boring, and being lost in your own more valuable thoughts isn't distraction. It's actually concentrating on something that's worthwhile. And then the other way that distraction is a complicated thing is that if you look at the self-help shelf, you get the sense that distraction is always bad. But it's not always bad. It's often good. So that's why writers work in coffee shops, because a little bit of distraction helps keep your brain humming along. And that's why my dentist likes to hum AM rock songs as a means of distracting you from the fact that you're at the dentist.
Does it work?
And it does work. He said he used to be a ski instructor. He told a story about when he used to be a ski instructor. You know, one thing ski instructors do is they distract scared students from the fact that they're slowly sliding down a mountain by talking a lot. And distraction helps you learn in that case. So basically, distraction is a more various and valuable thing than it's often assumed to be when we talk about it just as this scourge of modern life.
I buy all of that, Josh, but I wonder if another way of coming at this to understand what distraction really is to talk about our distractions, the things that we do that we think of distractions. And I'm going to put you on the spot, Andrew, and ask you, like, what comes to mind? What are the things that you know that you do that you think, oh, I'm now distracted, I'm doing X?
Sorry, I was just thinking about whether I wanted another cookie. I wasn't really paying attention. Kidding. I think that Josh is right, that what counts as distraction is context dependent. And so distraction to me is anything that I didn't mean to be attending to. Like, any time that I find myself like, wait, how did I end up on Facebook? How did I actually just click a banner ad? And it's not just the internet. I mean, this is why when you study meditation, which I have done, that is teaching you how to just be aware of the paths that your brain goes down, whether it is just sitting in a chair or in front of a screen or in a lecture. You don't have to be sitting in a lecture in order to struggle to pay attention. You could struggle to pay attention even when all the stimuli are stripped away. So to me, a distraction is anything that I didn't mean to do. Like Josh writes about, if I'm sitting in a movie theater and I decide this trailer is boring, I'm going to go check my email. That's not distraction. That's a decision. A distraction is when it's like, I didn't even know I took my phone out of my pocket. Mm-hmm. So it's all about control. I think the thing that freaks us out at this deep level is it feels like a loss of free will.
And something that you hit on was not even realizing you're doing it, which right. I think is a key component of what distraction is. You directed us to a TED talk by Sherry Turkle called Connected But Alone, in which she talks about the scourge of iPhones and what they're doing to social behavior. And one part of that really hit home to me when she was talking about how we do things with our phones now that we would never have considered to be proper behavior as recently as a decade ago. And an example of that in the workplace is, and David and I go to a meeting every day in which this happens, people are just sitting there on their phones, including me, mm-hmm. while other people speak. Mm-hmm. How is that decent behavior in a social world?
Oh, I'm so happy to defend that. because meetings are boring. I mean, it just gets what Josh was saying before. To my mind, when I'm in a meeting and you're talking about things that have varying degrees of importance to each mm-hmm. of the people as the meeting progresses, and there are times when it's really your turn to listen or speak and times mm-hmm. when it's not. And so I'm, you know, usually checking my email to see if there are other work things going on. Mm-hmm. And that I have no problem with. But as you were saying, Andrew, I mean, I did choose to do that. So maybe that's why it doesn't feel like a distraction
and
to me.
Also, just given the way our brains work.
Task 4. You are going to listen to the founder of eConscious Market explaining what it is about. First, you will have 45 seconds to study the task below. Then you will hear the recording twice. While listening, match the beginnings of the sentences, 1 to 7, with the sentence endings, A to J. There are two sentence endings that you should not use. Write your answers in the boxes provided on the answer sheet. The first one, 0, has been done for you. After the second listening, you will have 45 seconds to check your answers.
All right, so we're here today with Matthew Gerson answering the question, can we buy ourselves out of our social and environmental problems? We'll be discussing that question and others related to what we're calling conscious consumerism. Matthew is here from econsciousmarket.com, a philanthropic eco-marketplace on the web. You can find it at ecomkt.com. So tell us a little bit about Econscious Market and what you're up to. How is this transforming the world of business, and what is a philanthropic eco-marketplace anyway?
Well, let me answer the easy question first. The philanthropic eco-marketplace, we've spent the last year researching online, looking for environmentally and socially responsible products in terms of how they are produced, and looking at manufacturing processes and looking at, you know, the social effects of the way things are produced, not just the environmental effects of bringing those two mm-hmm. together. And we collected them all and built an eco mall, which many people are familiar with. And we decided to give away half the profits of the sales of those goods.
So you've got a bunch of great products.
We've got a bunch of, I mean, there's an amazing amount of stuff out there in various sectors, from clothing to furniture, bicycles. I mean, the more I started to dig, the more I discovered that it's not a really a niche market. It's just that most people don't know that there are products out there that are great. What would you say? Substitutes for a more conventionally produced product that you mm-hmm. could probably take everything in your house and almost find a socially and ecologically responsible counterpart for that. Mm-hmm. And so we tried to collect them in one place, make them easily available.
And so how big do you expect to grow with this?
It depends on our listening audience here, basically. If the last year's any judge, we actually think we could become one of the largest environmental portals online for these types of products.
That would be awesome.
Why do you think that'd be awesome?
Well, I don't know. I think it'd be awesome because there'd be a wide variety of goods and half the profits would be going back to nonprofits.
Right.
The wide variety of goods would help to transform the nature of our entire marketplace. The more companies out there we can have like yours. Mm-hmm. And I always feel a little uncomfortable calling them companies because they function so much more like nonprofits in so many ways. But the more companies we have out there like yours, the more we're going to be able to transform the whole nature of our system of exchange.
Well, if it helps at all, we like to consider our company a for-benefit company. Hmm. So we are sort of a hybridization of the for-profit and the non-profit sector. I mean, living in a culture where words have a tremendous amount of meaning, to call something a non-profit where we're also profit-driven is quite demeaning. So there is this movement. E-Conscious is just one of many companies in this movement towards creating a for-benefit filing for the IRS. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's really interesting because you literally are half nonprofit and half for profit because you're giving away 50% of your profits. And from what I understand, the user actually gets to choose the nonprofit, correct?
Yeah, that's a key part of what differentiates us from some of the other sites out there or organizations or movements where corporations are giving back to the social sector. Mm-hmm. We really want our consumers, you know, our customers, I should say, to get involved in the giving process. So it's their money. It's in their pocket. They worked for it. They're purchasing a product from us that they know is more environmentally or socially responsible. And they can say to us, this is important to me. This environmental group, this social group, this human rights group is important to me. Give my money to them and we'll do it. Mm-hmm.
The thing that I find most interesting about this is it completely turns the notion of exchange on its head.
All right, so we're here today with Matthew Gerson answering the question, can we buy ourselves out of our social and environmental problems? We'll be discussing that question and others related to what we're calling conscious consumerism. Matthew is here from econsciousmarket.com, a philanthropic eco marketplace on the web. You can find it at ecomkt.com. So tell us a little bit about eConscious Market and what you're up to. How is this transforming the world of business, and what is a philanthropic eco marketplace anyway?
Well, let me answer the easy question first. The philanthropic eco marketplace, we've spent the last year researching online, looking for environmentally and socially responsible products in terms of how they are produced, and looking at manufacturing processes, and looking at, you know, the social effects of the way things are produced, not just the environmental effects of bringing those two together. And we collected them all and built an eco mall, which many people are familiar with. And we decided to give away half the profits of the sales of those goods.
So you've got a bunch of great products.
We've got a bunch of, I mean, there's an amazing amount of stuff out there in various sectors, from clothing to furniture, bicycles. I mean, the more I started to dig, the more I discovered that it's not a really a niche market. It's just that most people don't know that there are products out there that are great. What would you say? Substitutes. Yeah.
Substitutes.
For
yeah.
a more conventionally produced product that you could probably take everything in your house and almost find a socially and ecologically responsible counterpart for that. Mm-hmm. And so we tried to collect them in one place, make them easily available.
And so how big do you expect to grow with this?
It depends on our listening audience here, basically. If the last year's any judge, we actually think we could become one of the largest environmental portals online for these types of products.
That would be awesome.
Why do you think that'd be awesome?
Well, I don't know. I think it'd be awesome because there'd be a wide variety of goods and half the profits would be going back to nonprofits.
Right.
The wide variety of goods would help to transform the nature of our entire marketplace. The more companies out there we can have like yours. Mm-hmm. And I always feel a little uncomfortable calling them companies because they function so much more like nonprofits in so many ways. But the more companies we have out there like yours, the more we're going to be able to transform the whole nature of our system of exchange.
Well, if it helps at all, we like to consider our company a for-benefit company. Hmm. So we are sort of a hybridization of the for-profit and the non-profit sector. I mean, living in a culture where words have a tremendous amount of meaning, to call something a non-profit where we're also profit-driven is quite demeaning. So there is this movement. E-Conscious is just one of many companies in this movement towards creating a for-benefit filing for the IRS. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's really interesting because you literally are half nonprofit and half for profit because you're giving away 50% of your profits. And from what I understand, the user actually gets to choose the nonprofit, correct?
Yeah, that's a key part of what differentiates us from some of the other sites out there or organizations or movements where corporations are giving back to the social sector. Mm-hmm. We really want our consumers, you know, our customers, I should say, to get involved in the giving process. So it's their money. It's in their pocket. They worked for it. They're purchasing a product from us that they know is more environmentally or socially responsible. And they can say to us, this is important to me. This environmental group, this social group, this human rights group is important to me. Give my money to them and we'll do it. Mm-hmm.
The thing that I find most interesting about this is it completely turns the notion of exchange on its head.
This is the end of the listening test.